So happy to have you back, Dimitri.
Good to be with you.
And let's get started with what's going on right now between Iran and Israel. How did you find these interactions between Iran and Israel? Right now, we had Iranian attack on Israel, and right now Israel is talking about they want to respond to what Iran did together with the United States, and they're talking about a coalition of 8 countries.
Well, the coalitions, that we can get rid of that idea to begin with. They tried that against Yemen, and that was ridiculous. So let's get rid of that idea immediately. In terms of the interaction, it was basically a disciplinary action, of Iranian disciplinary action against Israel, which is misbehaving. It's resorted to political assassination. And it was punished. And as a result of that punishment, there are a couple of interesting results. One, and probably the most important, is that Israel is defenseless. And Israel plus the United States is defenseless. So if Iran decides to demolish Israel's war-making ability, it can do so. It has the ability to do so. The Iron Dome system that's supposed to protect Israel is no more. It's spent. It's shot its rockets and now needs to be rearmed. And that's probably going to take months or years because the rockets that it uses are made in the United States and they take a long time to make. excuse me. Also, this was a good opportunity to look at the difference between this kind of rabid little animal that Israel has become, resorting to political assassination, you know, killing women and children, basically becoming a little terrorist, and Iran, which is much more magnanimous and measured. It didn't hit anything, any civilian targets in Israel at all. It concentrated on military installations, and the big prize was the unknown number, but non-zero number of F-35s. It's very expensive, but borderline useless American jets, and some other military installations that got hit as a result of this. The most important takeaway is that the hypersonic rockets that Iran possesses along with Russia, China, and North Korea cannot be stopped in any way by either Israel or by the United States. So in terms of a response, I think I know what that response is going to be from the United States. The United States is going to give the Israelis permission to strike targets in Syria, which it is already striking. The question is, can it still strike them given that its F-35s have been destroyed? But it could try. So just as with the Ukraine, there was a lot of going back and forth of whether to give the Ukrainians permission to do something that they're already doing. They're going to play up the fact that they're now magnanimously giving the Israelis permission to do what they've been doing for years, but announce that as a big new thing and a brave measure and la-di-da. And so that's basically as far as it's going to go, because the last thing that the Americans or the Biden administration specifically want going into the election is lots and lots of Americans coming back to the United States in flag-draped coffins from the many military bases still in the region, which, as we now know, the Iranians can pretty much hit at will and kill as many Americans as they want, and there's nothing that the Americans can do to stop them. So that's basically how I see the situation.
Yesterday, we've learned that Netanyahu was so desperate to talk with Putin. Can we understand what he was going to talk with Putin? What he was going to do? Mm. What was the main objective of this try on his part?
They have some things to discuss. One of them is that 20,000 dual citizens, Israeli-Russian citizens, basically Russian Jews, excuse me, have gone off to Israel to fight, which they saw as their patriotic duty. The problem is that Russia has a military conflict going on with the Ukraine, and the Ukraine is allied with countries that support, well, Israel is allied with countries that support the Ukraine, provided with weapons. And so Israel is on the enemy side from Russia. And so these 20,000 Jews are manifesting something called split loyalty. Are they Russian or are they Israeli? They live in Russia. They benefit from being part of the Russian state, and yet they go and side with Russia's enemies. What gives? Will these people be allowed to go back? Will they be imprisoned when they come back? Should they be stripped of their Russian citizenship? And what about all the other Israelis that are sort of, you know, they're Russian citizens, they're living in Israel, and when things go bad in Israel, of course, they'll head back home to Russia. What to do about them? Are they war criminals, any of them, by the fact that they're serving in Tzahal? Thorny issues to discuss at the political level. So Netanyahu probably wanted to know some details about that.
It seems that Russia wanted them to withdraw their troops from Lebanon. And this would be the most important thing right now for Russia. And how do you see the policy? And on the other hand, we had some air raids on the city of Idlib, together Russian army together with Syrian on the city of Idlib, because of this, they're calling them terrorist activities in that region. How do you see the Russia's policy right now in that region?
I don't think the policy has changed at all. Idlib province is in another part of the world. It is very, very far away from the theater of operations of the Israeli army. It's on the other end of Syria. And it's a gremlin preserve of sorts. That's pseudo-terrorists and sort of terrorists and et cetera have been herded and have been kettled for a long time now. And what has happened is that in its infinite wisdom, the State Department and the Pentagon decided to give some money to Ukrainian terrorists to go and train some more terrorists in Idlib to destabilize the situation in Syria, kind of thinking, well, we opened another front against Russia in the Kursk region, and that went famously badly, and we've lost something like 20,000 people there already and nothing to show for it except some horrible war crimes for which will be prosecuted. So why don't we open another front in Syria, send in some advisors and train some terrorists to do terrorism and play it that way? Well, that has nothing to do with Israel. That has nothing to do with the situation in the south of Syria and in Lebanon. As far as what Russia wants, It's unclear that Russia has any interest in stopping Iran from doing anything that Iran wants to do. I think what Russia is interested in doing is helping and equipping Iran to accomplish whatever Iran wants to accomplish, because they're partners and that's what partners do. So, for instance, Iran might need some help with up-to-date air defense systems or radio warfare electronics. And so Russians have been flying to Tehran and making various arrangements to make sure that Iran is well defended. Now, as far as what goes on with Israel, well, let's see. The fact that there's a hot war going on and Israel is embroiled with it will help clarify the politics, because you see something between a quarter and a third of Israelis are Russian citizens or have a right to a Russian citizen. Of course, some of them will want to go to the United States, you know, there's that can't be helped. But a lot of them will go to Russia when the time comes. And the time to start a process of filtration to figure out whether these people are war criminals or and whether they are loyal Russians or could ever be loyal Russians, that process should be started now. And there's nothing like a bit of a hot war to get that to happen. The other thing is that, you know, the whole Israeli project, as far as Russia is concerned, is at an end. It's at an impasse. So Russia is on the record saying it favors the two-state solution. Israel should leave occupied Palestinian territories, and there should be an independent, sovereign Palestinian government that Israel does not meddle with. So that has no chance of happening, given the politics in Israel and given the position of the Netanyahu regime. Therefore, the Russians are not getting what they want. And if the Russians don't get what they want, what do they care whether Israel exists or not? And lastly, the fact that all of this money that Americans have an ever shorter supply, since they're borrowing $35 billion a day just to keep solvent, instead of going to the Ukraine, it's now going to go to Israel. So to give you an idea of the scale, the federal budget or the government budget, state budget of Israel is about $140 billion a year. At least it was. I think it's down about 20% since the start of the war in Gaza and now in Lebanon. And then the war in Gaza, unsuccessful war, because Hamas is still exactly as it was. All of the people that got killed got replaced. Nothing has changed except half the buildings got destroyed and a lot of people are now dispossessed and angry, angrier than before. So that adventure cost about $100 billion. Gaza is pretty small. Israel lost lots of tanks, suffered lots of casualties, quite a bit of demoralization because something that was supposed to take 2 weeks has taken a year and is inconclusive. And now Israel is opening up another front, having learned absolutely nothing. So if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, this is going to probably be worse than the Lebanon war in 2006, I believe, which Israel lost. So this is going to be even worse and even more expensive. So from the Russian point of view, the fact that Israel is going to be sucking all of this money out of the United States means this money isn't going to the Ukraine. So the Ukraine will be left without any weapons and will be forced to retreat and surrender, which from the Russian point of view will save lives. And that's a good thing. So from the Russian point of view, the adventure in Lebanon is a good thing. I don't think that there's any doubt as to how it'll be concluded. It'll be another defeat for Israel. But in the meantime, there'll be more breathing space.
Yeah. You're back, Dmitry.
Yes, I'm back.
Yeah. Dmitry, when you look at the behavior of the government in Israel, with assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, and Iran said that they're gonna respond, but they didn't respond. We had a meeting in New York. The new president is trying to do something politically in New York, and again, they're assassinating Seyed Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. How the question is when it comes to the mind of Iranians or other countries, how they can deal? How can they deal with Israel? Because the way that they're behaving, just assassinating people, leaders, commanders, but nothing on the battlefield. If they want to fight, you can do it on the battlefield, not assassinating people. How we can understand their behavior? And right now they're following the same.
Well, it's the behavior of a cornered rat. It's the behavior of weak, small animals. They The thing is that, you know, big, huge animals, they don't really try to fight because any encounter could be lethal. So nuclear powers are very polite around each other, generally. Politicians might say all kinds of stupid things, but the military people are generally professional and polite, and they know how to avoid risk. We've seen that recently with permission denied by Pentagon to the White House to give permission to the Ukrainians to strike deep into Russia. That's a good example of that. Now, with Israel and with the Ukraine, they have no chance, and all they can do really is resort to these extremely pointless but violent techniques. Not even so much to achieve any sort of a positive or a useful military outcome, but just to bolster their own morale. Look, we got them, you know, we got their leader, and they're headless now. And so the image that they can paint in Israeli minds is, now Hezbollah is running around like a bunch of headless chickens. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you look at how Hezbollah is organized, it has nothing to do with its political authority in terms of its military structure. It's organized in units of between 250 and 500 fighters, each with its own command structure. Each with its own supply, and each with its own orders to defend a certain sector or a certain position. And what's more, they're all replaceable. So there's an infinite supply of replacements streaming in from Syria and from Iraq, just itching to fight the Israelis. So this is not something that Israel can destroy or even seriously damage, because what can they do? They can roll in with tanks. Those tanks will be destroyed because there's no shortage of shoulder-fired anti-tank weapons that Hezbollah has. They have huge stockpiles of them. They probably have 10 or 15 of those shoulder-fired tubes per Merkava tank. So those Israeli tanks are rolling into Lebanon. They're not rolling out. They're going to be scrap metal littering the countryside in southern Lebanon. So that's pretty much assured. What else can the Israelis do? Well, they can go back to their genocidal techniques and murder a whole bunch of Lebanese women and children, as they've already been doing. The civilian casualties are huge and growing. What's that going to achieve? It's going to make everybody even angrier at Israel, and will make Israel even more enemies, not at the level of Arab states, but at the level of the Arab street and of the people who are willing to go and fight Israel. So the longer this goes on, the more Israel bleeds, the more money it loses, the closer it gets to national bankruptcy, and to being abandoned as a lost cause by its supporters in the West.
You know, what was so strange before going into Lebanon, the Israeli forces, Netanyahu was talking a video message to Iranians talking about, we are going to free you, you're going to get rid of the government, we're going to help you to do that. And do you understand this behavior on his part? Because at the same time, assassinating, just going with the invasion of Lebanon and talking at the same time to Iranian people, is he trying to overthrow the government? Is this in his mind? Is that really believable with this type of attitude that we're witnessing from him?
Well, his attitude has nothing to do with reality. He thinks to Iranians that he's talking to the Lebanese. He's not. He's an object for people to throw vegetables and eggs at. You know, he looks ridiculous speaking English to these people, thinking that they'll understand him. I doubt that the people even bothered translating him into Arabic and Farsi. They just showed a picture of the, you know, image of the enemy. Here he is trying to speak to us. Ha ha ha. That's funny. You know, that's pretty much it. As far as Netanyahu himself, you know, he has more important things on his mind, such as how deep is his bunker? You know, is it deep enough? Given the situation, you know, he's a military target. You know, he's a commander. So his life could be not as long as he would like it to be.
Yeah. And the other thing is how the United States is trying to handle the situation in the Middle East. So far from the Biden administration, we haven't seen anything substantial in terms of bringing some sort of sanity to the conflict in the Middle East. At the same time, the situation in Gaza and right now with Lebanon, yesterday before this attack coming from Iran, they were talking about, it seems that in the mind of the Biden administration, they saw it as an opportunity for Israel to make more political gain on the battlefield with this offensive in the southern part of Lebanon. And right after this attack on the part of Iranians, it seems that they're changing their mind. They're just trying to adjust their policies. But it seems if Netanyahu does whatever he wants to do, it doesn't seem that the United States is capable of controlling him or making him understand that this type of policy would not work for him or Israel.
Well, look, the United States is not even able to control itself. I mean, right now you have a state within a state in the United States that's trying to figure out a plausibly deniable way to kill Trump. And they failed twice so far, but who knows how many more attempts they'll try. Failing that, they're trying to come up with some kind of a way to cook the election so that Kamala gets in, because if Kamala doesn't get in, then they're out of a job, all of them. And some of them don't even want to serve within the Kamala Harris administration. So Antony Blinken, for instance, the Secretary of State, already wrote his parting words and published them in I believe it was The Nation magazine, basically spelling out the completely bogus talking points that he wants State Department personnel to continue spouting after he's gone. But he doesn't want to continue in this business. I guess he wants to do something else with his life. I can't blame him, because he's done such a horrible job as a Secretary of State. You know, the whole Biden administration is one gigantic fiasco. So given that, what time do they have for the Middle East? What can they possibly do that's the least bit productive and positive when it comes to the Middle East? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And so the Biden regime, you know, which it's a regime minus Biden because his brain doesn't work. What are they going to do? Blinken is heading for the door. The Pentagon is telling them what to do to not trigger World War III, because they know that they're going to lose. And they don't want casualties. They know that. They know that they have all this military personnel in bases around the region. They don't even have the money to repatriate those troops. They don't want those troops to be repatriated in coffins right before the election. And that is the main concern for them. That is absolutely what they don't want. Everything else is secondary. Now, in terms of talking to Netanyahu, they've given up on that. They have realized that he is too far gone to even talk to. He is in a mode where he's looking for nothing more than even more shame.
The other thing would be if something big happened between Iran and Israel, together with the United States, would be the economy. How is that going to influence the economy, the price of oil? In your opinion, Is the United States prepared for that?
No, the United States is prepared to, at some point, declare sovereign default, but nobody knows when that's going to happen. It will have to zero out its defense budget at some point, because given the level of debt that it's taking on, as I said, it's $35 trillion a day, billion a day. This isn't something that can go on forever. And the way it registers is not in measured inflation, but in the effect of expenditure. So with this fake printed money, they can allocate any amount of money to any task, and it just won't get done. So to give you a specific example, a bridge that the Chinese would repair in 2 weeks, in Baltimore, that a ship slammed into, is going to take at least 5 years in the United States. And I don't think that it'll be finished in 5 years. I don't think it'll be finished in 10. I doubt that it'll ever be rebuilt. The number of derailments on the railroads in the United States has been at the level of 3 a day or something like that, compared to Russia, which has a bigger railroad system. Maybe one derailment a year, 3 a day, and it's going up. So at some point, the rail system in the United States, which is heavily used for freight, will no longer be usable, and there will be no way to bring it back, no matter how much fake printed money you throw at it. And on like that. So same thing with defense. The defense budget is huge and bloated and completely ineffectual. They're making more and more weapon systems that don't work, or at least they're trying to. They can't keep up with other countries, and that's definitely the case. So what can they do? They can't do anything. They can pretend, but the changes that have happened in American society and in American economy are irreversible.
And the other thing would be how the countries in the Middle East would react. Just today, we've learned that Turkey is talking about sending their troops to close to Idlib. Do we know what's going on right now between Russia and Turkey, and how do they manage these problems in that region?
Well, first of all, it's saying that region does an injustice to the situation, because northern Syria and southern Syria and Lebanon are almost two different countries. They're far away from each other. Idlib is a different issue from Lebanon completely. So Erdogan has said various things about Israel and Lebanon, as he always does. He will do nothing. I can absolutely promise that there will be no Turkish troops involved in Lebanon, and Syria will continue saying various things but doing nothing. As far as Idlib, well, that's a more intricate situation, because Turkey does want to be involved. On the other hand, politically, because it's important for Erdogan to appear strong to his own people. He can't say, well, we're just leaving Syria and all these Syrians that we have, millions of them living among us for years. They'll just continue living among us, and we'll do nothing to fix the situation so that they can go home. You know, that's not a good position for him. He can't really say, okay, well, we tried, we couldn't, and we'll leave it up to Russia and Syria and Iran to sort out. They have to be part of the game. So they're doing something, okay? But much of that is internal politics. You have to make a distinction between internal Turkish politics and Turkish foreign policy, whatever that is. I don't think that amounts to much. Turkey has been very careful in not putting too many troops at risk in northern Syria. There are some functions that they do serve, because there's a Turkish population there. that they have to at least try to defend. But they don't really want a very much mission creep there at all. And they want good relations with Syria. They've realized that that's pretty important at this point, that that's actually on strategy for them. And that's a good sign.
And we've seen how the King of Jordan was talking about the situation in the Middle East. And he was criticizing Israel. But at the same time, right now, they're trying to defend Israel. And they're so proud of defending Israel right now, just announcing that we hit three missiles, Iranian missiles, in order to help Israel. And this is one side of the story. And the other part is the public opinion in Jordan, which is totally against this type of policy of the King of Jordan. How do you see the situation in Jordan, and how do you think that they're having any sort of plan for the future, and how they're going to react to any sort of big fight that is going to happen between, if happens, between Iran and Israel?
They're going to try to look purposeful, but what else can they do? It's a schizophrenic country. First of all, it's a kingdom, so that tells you just how democratic it is. Secondly, the king's wife is a Palestinian, so that tells you what the actual loyalties are. Third, I think it's pretty close to a majority Palestinian, or it's a very large majority, very large minority, Palestinian minority in that country. And we know what loyalties those people have, certainly not pro-Israel. And lastly, the country exists at the pleasure of the Americans. It does get military aid. It does get financial aid from the United States. So it has to be very careful not to displease the American masters. And the big danger is that the United States will kind of forget that they exist and stop paying attention to them. And then they'll have a big problem, because the way they hold the country together is through some amount of social spending. So if there's no money coming in for that, what can they do? So the king plays this this game of, oh, we're shooting down missiles because, you know, we can do something. And in any case, they have to keep up the military morale. So they have weapons, air defense systems. So they shot down some rockets, some missiles that the Iranians fired exactly for that purpose. You see, there was a mix of rockets. Some were designed to deplete air defense systems, nothing else. I don't even know whether they had an explosive payload or not. Maybe they were just, empty shells flying to trick air defense systems into depleting their supply of very expensive air defense rockets. So they lost a couple of, at a minimum, four rockets at something like $1 million each to shoot down some junk that that the Iranians have sitting around in some cave somewhere. So that accomplished something politically, didn't accomplish anything at all militarily.
And when it comes to the conflict in the Middle East, with these new escalations between Iran and Israel right now, the United States and other countries, we can draw two conclusions. One of them is have a bigger fight between these countries and just ignoring what's going on in Gaza, or getting to Gaza. The main issue is Gaza right now. We have to remember that, because Gaza is behind all of this conflict. And just address the issue, just going to find some sort of solution for the conflict in Gaza. How do you see right now the international community? We know that on the part of Russia, they know what's going on, what would be the solution for Gaza. But how about the other countries? Do you see any sort of understanding in these countries that the main issue is Gaza, is not Iran, is not Israel, is not Lebanon? And we have to come up with a solution about the situation between Israel and Gaza and Palestinians?
Oh, I don't think there is a solution. And I think a lot of people realize that there isn't one. You have to understand all problems have a solution. There's an entire set of problems, even in just abstract mathematics, that do not have a solution and never will. I think the the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a problem that does not have a solution, except you can cancel out one of the variables. Given the demographics and given the economics of the region, I would say that it's far more likely that Israel would get canceled because it's so much more expensive and there's a shortage of money. So in the interests of saving money, it is much more cost effective to scrap Israel than to scrap the entire Palestinian people, which would be the choice. So given that, in the long run, I think Israel will go away.
How did you find the latest visit of Zelensky to the United States in terms of the way that he wanted to gain some sort of support from the Biden administration, from NATO? And right now, considering the situation that they're having in Ukraine, in terms of, it seems that the head of intelligence of Ukrainian, he's talking about he's going to resign. And we had Zelensky, the foreign minister of Ukraine, right now the head of intelligence. The whole government is collapsing. And how do you find it right now?
Well, it's rats fleeing from a sinking ship. I'm pretty sure that Zelensky himself would like to just go play with his kids instead of playing president of a country that is getting smaller every day. But they won't let him. They're torturing him. The Americans won't let him go. And it's quite apparent that, you know, he's sick and tired of playing president of this role. And he's no longer even elected. So he's just basically, he's an actor playing president of a non-existent country. How much more pathetic can you get? And he's being manipulated into basically cheering on the destruction of what's left of his people. A lot of the recruits don't survive more than a day or two at the front. And they keep sending people there. They keep giving them small arms and sending them to the front. And then they're killed with using bombs dropped from very far away that weigh a ton and a half that just completely blow them to tiny pieces so that you can't even identify the bodies. And that's his job. I can't imagine anything more pathetic. And then he flies to the United States and lo and behold, he's suddenly campaigning for Kamala Harris, which is even more ridiculous. And then, of course, that was a stupid move on the part of the Democrats to use this this image of failure to juice up this flagging campaign. And then, of course, there's upheaval amongst the Republicans who say, justly so, who is this foreign agent who is campaigning and interfering with our internal political process? Justly so. And the Speaker of the House of Representatives demands that the very silly woman, the ambassador, quote unquote, ambassador of the Ukraine and the United States, be dismissed, be fired. She had no idea what she was doing. She thought that this would be a very nice photo op, signing artillery shells, Zelensky signing artillery shells that are going to Israel. They're not going to the Ukraine anymore because there's no more stuff to send to the Ukraine. It's all going to Israel now. So it's all just absolutely pathetic, completely pathetic and stupid.
And we have the new Secretary General of NATO right now. And do you see any sort of change coming to this alliance, to the concept that they're having toward the conflict in Ukraine?
Yeah, well, if Trump gets elected, Trump is going to say, no, NATO is too big and too centrally controlled. So let's give it some regional structure. And let's fire Rutte, because who the hell is he anyway? Let's just have military people in control. And let's make them all Americans. Why do we have this Dutch person controlling what is an American alliance? So that's kind of what Trump would probably do. So Rutte is just basically a placeholder. And what he's going to do is he's going to impersonate his predecessor to the best of his ability. And that's about it.
Biden tweeted with this visit of Zelensky, Biden tweeted that Ukraine is going to win and we're going to support Ukraine. But with those two meetings between Biden and Zelensky, and then between Donald Trump and Zelensky, what can we get really? What would be the outcome of these two meetings for the future of the conflict?
Well, the intern who wrote the tweet for Biden deserves a gold star and a cookie, you know. That was good. Sounds positive. As far as what it actually means, nothing. Nothing.
And do you think that the United States is getting to the point with the conflict in the Middle East that the aid to Ukraine gonna just diminish and just fading away, and they're gonna maybe send some sort of message to Zelensky, to everyone in Ukraine, that we have to negotiate? Is that coming, in your opinion?
Well, they can pretty much do whatever they want, but what Russia for is unconditional surrender, not negotiation. And Russia will get what Russia wants. Make no mistake about that. What Russia wants is victory. Does negotiation sound like victory? Will the Russian people say, oh, you sat down and started talking to our sworn enemies, therefore we won? Let's have some parades coming up on the giant anniversary of our World War victory in the Great Patriotic War. Does that sound good? No, it sounds bad. What Russia wants is outright victory and complete destruction of the Ukrainian regime. And then Russia will decide where to draw the borders, which part goes back to Russia, which is where it came from, and which parts go to whoever wants them, Poland, Hungary, Romania. Go ahead and fight over it, because we don't want it. And so that's the end game. Not some sort of negotiation, and then involving the European Union or the United States in that negotiation is non-starter. They're not participants. If they want to be participants, then it's World War III. If they don't want World War III, then they're not participants, and they have to make up their mind.
Yeah, the Polish government right now, it seems that they're not having that much of a good relationship with Ukrainians. And is that an outcome of the new policies within NATO, or is something between the Polish government and Ukrainians?
It's not even the government, it's just reality intruding. The Poles have lots of Ukrainians on their territory. They're close to the Ukraine. They understand the language. There's quite a bit of interpenetration, and they can't deny the fact that the Ukraine as a whole is at an end. So now they suddenly started talking about partitioning what's left of the Ukraine, because if they don't grab a chunk of it that was theirs before, they'd look like losers. So what they're thinking is, well, where's our prize? I mean, we showed up, we sent mercenaries, a lot of them died, half of them died. We lost military, lots of equipment in this that we donated. We fixed up a lot of stuff. They had repairs. We served as a transshipment point for opened up an airport for lots and lots of traffic. Where's our money? So that's what the Poles are thinking. Where's ours? Well, how are we going to get what's coming to us? And so this is fighting over the scraps. Hungary is sort of sitting back and waiting for Russia to hand the Hungarian part of the former Ukraine to Hungary on a silver platter, I guess. I don't know what the Romanians are thinking. I think the Romanians are thinking maybe we didn't do enough. Maybe we should just do something to get our piece. But that's basically where it's going.
Yeah. The main issue in this equation in Ukraine would be the situation on the battlefield, which is so important when it comes to the solution, when it comes to to putting an end to this conflict. How is the situation of the Ukrainian army right now? In Ugledar, we learned that they're withdrawing the troops. And how about the other places?
Ugledar is surrounded on three sides. There's a road that goes out, but anybody who tries to go through that road gets killed because it's being monitored, and anything that moves on that road gets shelled. So they lost all of their equipment that they drove in with. There's a lot of people. I think well over 1,000. I don't know how many thousands of people are still Ukrainians are still stuck in Ugledar, trying to find their way out. The way they're doing it is in groups of 10. And the statistics are that out of every 10, only 4 or 5 survive, maybe at this point 3 or 4. Because what they have to do is they have to go through minefields and forests, and they get shelled anyway. They're found. The weather is cool enough so that they just really show up on infrared very easily. So they're killed using anything that the Russians can throw at them. And so Ugledar is being bled out. And this will go on until there are no more Ukrainian forces, Ukrainian troops left in Ugledar. And then the Russian military machine will move on. And the last two cities on the left bank of the Dnieper is Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. Once those are done, then the Ukraine is gone from the left bank of the Dnieper. And the Russian operation to take over the right bank of the Dnieper will start just as it started in World War II, when they were flushing the German Nazis out of the Ukraine. That's a road well traveled. The Russians know how to fight that war, and they will do it again. It's a repetition.
Yeah. And what do we know, Dmitry, about the situation in the Kursk region?
Well, the funny thing about Kursk is that it's a trap. And what the Ukrainians have to do is keep sending troops or keep trying to send troops into Kursk, into the little sliver of Kursk around Sudra and the surrounding villages. Because the moment they start doing that, the Russians will basically sweep through and clean the place out and reestablish the security at the border. And then the whole Kursk mission is done, and it's a defeat, and the Ukrainians won't be able to hide it. Which would be a major, major problem for them.
Right now, it seems that Germany, Olaf Scholz, wants to talk with Vladimir Putin. And do you think that Germany is changing its policy toward Russia because of those pressures coming from within the society of German people, within the government, within the what's going on, considering what's going on in Germany in terms of their economy?
Well, I think Putin would talk to Scholz at some cocktail reception for former heads of state, because that's the way it's heading. Right now, what's happening in Germany is that the German system, if you will, is struggling with keeping out the people who won the elections. Same thing happening in Austria, same thing happening in France. Basically, the realization has survived that these countries are not democracies, that it doesn't matter who wins the elections. There's this establishment that reports to Washington, and Washington tells them to not let in these barbarians who won the elections, the Freedom Party in Austria, for instance. So basically, Olaf is a placeholder. He's an American stooge. He's not a head of state, so why would Putin talk to him?
But does Russia consider in the future to have relationship? Because AfD and these parties in Germany, they're interested in having those pipelines working again between Russia, those pipelines, Nord Stream pipelines, working again between Russia and Germany, because that's so crucial, that's so important for the economy of Germany. It's not just AfD, we have the left-wing party, and they're talking the same thing about what's going on in Germany.
Well, the Germans have finally realized that without cheap Russian energy, they're done. The problem is that cheap Russian energy is history. First of all, Russia has already sold a lot of that gas that was supposed to have been going to Germany to China. Secondly, it's Russia's policy to trade with friendly nations, not with hostile nations. And Germany, with its support for the Ukraine, the former Ukraine, has proven itself to be a hostile nation. Lastly, it is beneficial for Russia to trade with countries that are powerful, growing, industrial or industrializing economies, whereas Germany is past peak. Its peak of industrial production was in 2008. It's been downhill ever since, and it's going to continue going downhill. So why is Germany on strategy for Russia? That's a big question. So the Germans may want that cheap Russian energy back, but is that anything more than wishful thinking at this point? It seems to me like the train has left the station a long time ago, and it's no use running down the tracks trying to catch it.
And just to wrap up this session, Dmitry, do you think, can we understand the behavior of the United Kingdom right now? It seems that the animosity they're having toward Russia is growing, and nobody knows what's going on in the United Kingdom, and why are they doing this?
They're doing this because they had this plan of that could be called let's you and him fight, basically run interference between Russia and the United States and cause a conflict, and then maybe pick up some scraps from what flies as a result. Didn't work out very well. The government in Great Britain is in dire straits already. It's ever less popular and ever less capable of achieving anything for the people. There's this kaleidoscopic effect when it comes to prime ministers. They seem like these insects that are hatched, fly around for a couple of days, breed, lay eggs, and are gone, except that these insects don't even breed or lay eggs. They just flap around for a while and then die. So who remembers Theresa May? And who's going to remember Starmer in another 2 weeks or 2 months or a year? So there's no reason to even pay attention to them. And yes, they're saying terrible things about Russia. And why are they saying them? Because the alternative is to talk about themselves, and that's not a winning strategy for them given the situation in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dimitri, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.